The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hearing, hearing, hearing. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Be seated, please.
The first case on our calendar is 96-2204, State of Ohio versus Lee Edward Moore, Jr. Ms. Agar.
Thank you, Your Honor. Unless the court has some other areas that it's interested in addressing, I'd like to move to some of the problems with the specifically defense counsel's conduct of litigation and some conduct of the prosecutor's litigation. I think that anybody reading the transcript of Dr. Stone's testimony has got to realize that testimony came over the bride and shot the defense counsel. They were not prepared for it. That when they placed Dr. Stone on the witness stand, they had no idea that this is what he was going to say. The testimony that Dr. Stone gave contradicted given by the defense in this case instead of any hope for the jury that there were any circumstances in this case. To have the defendant take the stand and give an unsworn statement claiming that the killing in this case was an accident, that it was not premeditated or planned out in advance, that it was a spur-of-the-moment fear type of situation, and to present his entire statement in that light, and then to place Dr. Schiaffoni on the stand to testify that, oh yeah, the defendant told me not only that this was planned out in advance, but that it was done to avoid detection, and that he tried to make it look like an accident afterwards, it's simply not a defense strategy that can in any way shape or form be met.
Did that testimony come out of direct or cross?
Excuse me?
That testimony come out of direct or cross?
That I'm not sure of, Your Honor.
Well, wouldn't that be important in terms of determining whether the defense counsel was competent or incompetent in putting on a statement?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because however the testimony was elicited, it was not deliberately elicited. The defense counsel didn't say, doctor, didn't the defendant tell you he did this on purpose that he planned it? If it was elicited on direct, it was purely accidentally, I believe, elicited on cross. But in any event, there's no possible way the defense counsel could know this testimony was coming. The testimony was absolutely devastating to their entire litigation.
Counsel, you need to go to the issue of what was deficient about counsel's performance. Isn't that the basis for that claim? Is that it's ineffective assistance in the preparation of this, or what is it?
That's correct.
Testimony comes out in trials all the time. It surprises folks.
Certainly. But this is a case where the person who is testifying is allegedly the mitigation expert appointed to assist counsel to prepare mitigation.
I understand.
So we're not talking about a hostile witness here or one who could be expected to conceal from defense counsel vital information. This is also not an inexperienced witness. Dr. Schiaffoni is an employee of the court psychiatric clinic in Hamilton County who testifies on numerous occasions. This is not a situation where the doctor would not have known.
Well, what you're really arguing is that it was ineffective assistance of counsel for defense counsel to call this doctor and put him on in mitigation. Isn't that the heart of your argument?
No, Your Honor. The heart of the argument is that they were ineffective in failing to speak to the witness.
Well, it all goes hand in hand. If the defense attorney had spoken with this is in your opinion, if the defense counsel had spoken to this doctor, heard what he was going to say, he would not have put him on if he was an effective defense attorney?
He would either not have put him on, or the entire mediation strategy would have been different.
But for us to find an effective assistance of counsel, the heir, you'd have to look at this case and it is and come to the conclusion that it's only because of the doctor's testimony that the death penalty was given. Isn't that true?
I don't think you'd have to come to the conclusion that it's only because of the doctor's testimony, but I do think a fair reading of this transcript of the mediation hearing would leave the court clearly unable to say that this wasn't the testimony that tipped the scales here. Again, totally devastating any mitigation presentation. Once Dr. Schiaffone testified, the defense mitigation presentation was over for all intents and purposes. There was no way to recover from it, and no way to go back.
But all that evidence that the doctor testified to was already in evidence, wasn't it? By the prosecution's witnesses who testified exactly how this killing took place, the defendant's remarks after the killing, that was all in evidence, wasn't it?
Certainly there was no evidence that the defendant had given a full confession stating that he killed this person in order to avoid detection, and that he planned to kill it, and then kill him in advance, and then he attempted to make it look like an accident. That was not a matter.
But wasn't his statement about, that was easy, did you see his dome blow off, wasn't that in evidence?
There was some testimony by co-defendants or people who allegedly had heard him make some statements. None of those statements were of the scope and quality of Dr. Schiaffone's testimony. Nothing that indicated that this was a premeditated.
Well, the doctor's testimony was simply frosting on the cake.
Well, there was nothing prior to the doctor's testimony that couldn't have been basically perfect after an accidental shooting, you know, bragging or boasting amongst friends, the kind of drunken comments that would be likely to go on under those circumstances, something that could be explained in terms of presentation.
If the defense had not called Dr. Schiaffone, would there have been a question of privilege between the defendant and Dr. Schiaffone with regard to his revelations?
Yes, I believe so, because this was not a case where the defense requested either a competency or an insanity or a pre-sentence report. Dr. Schiaffone was appointed to be the mitigation expert, part of the defense team, to assist in preparation of mitigation.
Well, all the information that you complained about in answer to Justice Pfeiffer's question came out in cross-examination. Is there a waiver?
Once they put him on the stand and elicit his testimony, yes.
I'm not talking about the waiver of the privilege. I'm talking about, is there a waiver to object on the basis that how can we look into defense counsel's mind and not be sure that that wasn't a defense strategy, that maybe they had nothing else?
It was a defense strategy
to call Dr. Schiaffone. I'm not sure what it was. You know, the business of the baby was due pretty shortly and there was time. Maybe he didn't have time to spend with the doctor. Is all of interest, maybe even prejudicial. But do they waive it by calling the doctor and eliciting the testimony?
Well, if defense counsel is already ineffective in failing to adequately prepare the mitigation, then I think that if defense counsel's actions are now interpreted as a waiver of any right the defendant has to object to that evidence.
Other than the 3 days or whatever it is, what can you point to that there was not adequate preparation for the mitigation phase?
Well, I believe that counsel actually informed the judge at the time that that 3-day period was scheduled, but at that point in time they had not spoken to Dr. Schiaffone and not interviewed him. So all the preparation for mitigation was done in that 3-day period while one counsel was expecting the child.
Is that in the record?
I believe it is, Your Honor. Assuming there is, counsel,
I don't know how, this, that we can, are you asking us to presume that, that they never talked to Dr. Shapiro? Or do you think that you think we should infer from this?
Well, I find it hard to conceive that Dr. Shapiro, who was appointed to assist in the case, was by interviewing an experienced witness, if he had sat down with defense counsel and discussed in depth his interview with the defendant and what that interview revealed, would not have revealed this information.
But I mean, let's say he did, that they did have a discussion with him, and if they had any sort of discussion, I'm sure you could do the preparation within 3 days if you were able to meet with the witness. That's the typical preparation. Let's say that he said, now look, your client has told me this, this, and this, that he, you know, did it to cover up. And they counsel then says, what do you have to say about mitigation? He said, well, you know, I can say all these good things. And they say, you are appointed to do this. You're our only witness for those good things you have to say, helpful things. We'll rattle the dice and they hope that it doesn't, that what you know isn't brought out on cross. Is that an unreasonable strategy?
But Dr. Shapiro is not the only source of this material. Dr. Shapiro learned this material from places other than the defendant. Other witnesses are available to present this material if defense counsel has adequate time to prepare, takes adequate time to prepare, goes out and finds these other witnesses, interviews the family members, puts them on the stand, and Dr. Shapiro.
But they might not have thought that mom and, you know, mom saying these same things would be as persuasive to jurors as Dr. Shapiro. That, you know, the primary sources are as persuasive. I mean, and then they have to say, but he might get caught. And then can you strategically take a chance like that?
You know, I don't believe that is borne out by the record. For one thing, counsel asked for an instruction on residual doubt and argued residual doubt in mitigation. To then place Dr. Shapiro's testimony on the record.
Well, they did.
Complete confession.
But you know, they didn't put that on the record. You're saying that's a jump there, isn't
I'm
it?
Saying by putting him on the stand,
with the risk that he will
certainly
in cross-exam.
And I have great respect for Mr. Pete Meyer. I cannot believe that under any circumstance, given the chance to cross-examine Dr. Shapiro, he wouldn't have gone into whether the defendant made any statements to him that were detrimental to his defense.
But this is not, you're indicating that this is really a very, very unusual thing to happen. There isn't a witness go by that a counsel isn't surprised on direct or redirect what he says. That's not an unusual occurrence, is it?
When you're dealing with lay witnesses, it's not an unusual occurrence at all. When you're dealing with your own expert witness, yes, it's an unusual occurrence.
This never happens with expert witnesses.
If you prepare your expert witness properly, you should not be devastatingly surprised by some fairly obvious.
But the occurrence, whether expert or not, is not really something that is, doesn't happen in every case. There isn't a witness that you test or you question that sometimes you come away and say, whoa, where did he get that? You never said anything like that to me. But that's not unusual, is it?
I believe it is with an expert witness. I don't believe that an adequately prepared counsel places an expert witness on the stand without a solid understanding of what that person's testimony is going to be. This is their expert. He's employed and appointed to assist them in the preparation of the defense.
But how would they have prepared him so that he didn't talk about this? What would they have said to him that would have kept this out under skillful cross-examination without actually lying?
I don't believe that they could have. And for that reason, I believe that if they were aware of it, they would not have placed him on the stand.
And
they
would
not have the collateral sources to get the mitigation into evidence.
And if they had not put him on the stand, wouldn't you be up here now with an ineffective assistance of counsel argument because they didn't have a mitigation expert?
Now, actually, it's fairly rare for us in Hamilton County to put the mitigation expert on the stand. The last death penalty case I tried, my mitigation expert didn't take the stand. My mitigation expert uncovered the collateral sources for me and helped me prepare them, but he never testified. So that's not an unusual situation. And on the whole, I think, especially in an emotional situation like mitigation, that the collateral sources usually are your best source of this information. Family members are far more likely to touch the jury in an emotional situation than a psychologist is.
I want to go back to the three-day period because that, to me, has a potential of being prejudicial. I asked you whether or not that three-day period was, in fact, a significant factor in what could you appoint to. You said that, in fact, that the defense counsel requested a continuance. Justice Sweeney asked you, is that in the record? And you said, yes, or I believe so. My question is, why would you then say in Proposition Law Number 13, where a trial counsel fails to request adequate time to prepare for the penalty phase after guilty verdicts?
No, I may have misunderstood the question. I didn't understand that you were asking me whether they requested a continuance. I indicated that they told the judge at the time that they were scheduling the mitigation hearing that they had not yet had time to interview Dr. Chacon.
You say that he told the judge that. Counsel told the judge that.
The judge said, can we start the mitigation right away? They said, well, we haven't had a chance to even interview Dr. Chacon yet. We can't start right now.
So we need adequate time.
So it was set over until Monday.
Okay. Well, if you say that, then why is the proposition of law where trial counsel fails to request adequate time? Because you're telling us he did.
Well, I'm saying that the 3 days was not adequate time to start the mitigation preparation. If they had been doing the mitigation preparation all throughout the trial prep, then perhaps 3 days is adequate time. But if they had not even spoken to the mitigation expert at the time that this verdict comes in, it's clear they had not started their mitigation preparation. How could they have started their mitigation preparation if they had not even spoken to their court-appointed mitigation expert? And they had not even interviewed him once. So I'm saying that at the time the verdict came in, nothing had been done to prepare mitigation in this case. And defense counsel, instead of requesting adequate time to make that preparation, agreed with the court that they could do it in 3 days' time, including the initial interview and mitigation.
Is that the norm, that when you're preparing to defend a death penalty case with strong evidence against your client, that you don't at the same time lay out a strategy or a roadmap or find your witnesses?
It would certainly not be the way that I would try that case.
You can assure us that nothing was done with respect to mitigation at all prior to the returning of the verdict.
I can't say that nothing was done by Dr. Chacon, because it's clear that Dr. Chacon had done some interviewing of the defendant and some things of that sort.
How much time did he spend with this defendant? Over what time frame?
I'm sure that appears in Dr. Chacon's testimony in terms of how many times he had spoken to the defendant and what time that would be normal, but I don't have that information in front of me.
So it's more than once, and it's over a period of weeks or months?
I would believe more likely over a period of weeks than months, but yes, I'm sure that he spoke to him on at least several occasions. The problem is...
So the comments that came out of Cross are part of an extensive amount of time and interview time with the defendant.
Yeah, I can't go into Dr. Chacon's mind and say exactly how he conducted his investigation, but ordinarily a mitigation expert would start off with an in-depth interview with the defendant to get not only the details of the defense, but also the background information, families.
Did Dr. Chacon have a written report that he furnished to trial counsel?
Does not appear in the record that he does. If there was one, it does not appear in the record.
So there's nothing that you could advance that would indicate
that his testimony is all we have.
That he in a written report, alerted to trial counsel to this conversation that came tumbling out across.
There's no written report in the record. There's no reference to a written report in the record. So there's nothing that we can point to specifically to say that the document won't be done.
You've concentrated on this issue. Is there something else in your limited time that
I would just say that
you think we ought to be focusing on?
You can look at this also in the context of some of the comments that were made by the prosecutor during mitigation, the references that were made to defense counsel's attempts to confuse the jury and draw the smoke in the case. Very clear instructions by the prosecutor to the jury that they can weigh emotional factors such as Mr. Olinger's fear and his state of mind as an aggravating circumstance. I know that this is an issue that this court addresses time and time again, and they're raised constantly by the defense there any time a prosecutor makes some reference to the nature and circumstances of the crime and closing argument. But what we have here is a little more than some reference. But the prosecutor specifically said, look at this terrible thing that this victim was put through. This is an aggravating circumstance that you can weigh against the mitigation, and specifically instructed the jury on several occasions that was the case. I think if you look at the problems with the defense presentation in context of things that were said by the prosecutor and the prosecutor was allowed to say, the comments that he was allowed to make with regard to defendant's unsworn statement and the fact that it was not under given subject to cross-examination, the comments that the trial court actually urged the prosecutor and indicated that he believed he was making the prosecutor in the same place. If you look at that, those things in context, the mitigation in this case did not give the defendant a fair opportunity to present an argument for life rather than.
Thank you, Ms. Agar. Mr. Breyer.
Please support counsel. I agree with defense counsel on one thing. There's really only two matters to discuss here. I personally think there's really only one, and that's the issue of mitigation, which of course is good, but most of those questions too. I would like to make one comment before I get to that about this last minute references here to prosecutor's closing argument. This case presents itself a little different than the aggravated murder case that we did have in specification. Because what happened to this defendant right up until the very end he died in the record? As you'll recall, one of the co-defendants testified for the state described last minutes of Mr. Olinger's life, including the fact that he begged for his life before he was shot. So thus, the prosecutor's references to that are not speculation or anything of that nature. They're references to the facts that are actually in the record. And those facts are the nature and circumstances of the aggravating circumstances of kidnapping. So there was absolutely no impropriety in referring to those remarks at all. I don't think there's any legitimate claim of prosecutorial misconduct and harm. Counsel made reference to the fact that the prosecutor used the word smokescreen. That term actually was in the guilt phase, not in the penalty phase. And it was in direct response to an argument by defense counsel who told the jury, we're not here to pull the wool over your eyes. And in fact, when the prosecutor used the term smokescreen, he said, you'll recall that defense counsel said such and such and such and such. It was a clear response to what was said by defense counsel. I don't think there's any legitimate claim this court would be properly doing this claim to prosecutor this conduct argument. Really, it's a non-issue in the case.
Mr. Breyer, if in one of these cases the state had a defendant examined by two psychiatrists, and they were the state's witnesses, the state's psychiatrists, and the one psychiatrist said, knew exactly what he or she was doing, knows right from wrong. In fact, this was all premeditated. And the other one said, crazy as a loon. The Would you call the second one?
I would not call the second one, but I fully expect that the defense attorney would call the second one. Present that because he, of course, had access to it.
So had they not called the doctor, you would have?
Yes, we would have. This person was appointed not... we really don't have to get the issue of privilege. This person was appointed as an, quote, mitigation expert. There's no mitigation expert privilege in the state of Ohio. He would have been called by either side to testify as to what he would do. So, no, I don't think that... once that witness is in possession of that knowledge is fair game on either side to produce a trial. But I really think that this admission is really not a really big deal on the facts of this particular case. You'll recall that this defendant, first of all, just before I get to that, I'd just like to make this comment. There's been a lot of things made here, representations made, arguments made. In fact, the entire argument that the defense counsel is making is based on an assumption that trial counsel did not prepare this witness for the mitigation hearing. There's absolutely nothing in this record which would substantiate such a claim. Back in the case of State versus Hunt.
Do you recall the record that was stated by counsel that the defense counsel did tell the court, well, gee, Judge, we never have yet talked to Dr.
There was, Judge, correct. There was a discussion between the defense counsel about their findings, what they were going to be able to do, and what they planned to do between now and the final hearing date. And one of the defense attorneys did state that he was there to stand the problem, but there were two defense attorneys in particular case, only one of them had that particular problem.
You're saying that the record doesn't support one?
The record supports the fact that one of the attorneys indicated that as of yet they hadn't continued their interviews with Dr. Ciccone after yet it was done. However, it does not indicate that they did not do that.
But there was no... I'm sorry.
I didn't follow you. They said counsel properly let us know what that said, or she
said... Several days before the mitigation hearing,
right.
They advised the court as to their status and what they had yet to do.
Which included
talking about
finishing. And do you agree that that's the first step in preparing for litigation?
Well, actually, the records are reflect that Dr. Ciccone was contacted by these people to be their mitigation expert, that over a period of time, he interviewed them on five different occasions.
Yeah.
That he had a staff employee who visited the defendant and administered testing. So,
no, I think that the first step for the counsel is the first step for defense counsel with regard to mitigation to interview and learn what the mitigation expert has to add.
Well, the first step is to get him to do his job.
They did that part.
Yes.
No,
the second step is to put it all together.
There's no indication in the record that they didn't start at all on the mitigation preparation, is there?
No, to the contrary.
From what I take it, that the only thing they really had not done in the preparation for the mitigation defense is they hadn't talked to the doctor.
Well, I'm not seeing they hadn't talked to the doctor.
Or
they hadn't put it together. They hadn't had their final preparation meeting. But the record will reflect that 3 days before the hearing, they hadn't had their final meeting to put it together. The record will show that. But the record will not show in the interim they did not do that.
Well, there's indication that they didn't start anything towards the defense until after the case and the case is over.
The record will not show that. The record is going to show that this Dr. Ciccone had been at this for quite some time. The record's also going to reflect that they called three other witnesses to beg questions in detail. It's obvious they knew what they were asking when they questioned these witnesses. I personally think that in a case like this where you're making arguments that the defense attorney did things or did not do things and the record will not substantiate it, this is the question that has to be brought up in post-conviction where you can obtain the affidavits from the attorney and develop a record. There's no way you can come before this court and say the record shows they didn't prepare this witness because the record does not reflect that. What the record does reflect is they put on what's become the standard mitigation defense in capital cases, and that is the life history defense. Dr. testimony presented a very detailed life history of this particular defendant. He indicated the vast amount of time he had spent with him, the tests he had done with him. They presented three other witnesses who did the same thing, family members and friends who did the same thing. It's very clear they were prepared and presented a very well put together life history of mitigation, which has really become just about the standard defense and how the case that was done. The problem arises here because Dr. Cipone was interviewing this particular defendant. He admitted to him that, in fact, he had done this purpose. And counsel is now making a big deal that this was a terrible shock to the jury and it impacted on their mitigation and on counsel's effectiveness. The fact of the matter is, you can't get around this. The jury had already found him guilty of aggravated murder, purposely killing this person, and he did it to escape detection. The jury already knew this. They had already convicted him of it. How did this come as a shock to the jury?
Did you know what the testimony of the doctor was going to be?
Well, the record won't reflect that.
So we don't know.
Right, the record won't reflect that. It's not in the record.
What was the time frame and presentation of the sentencing phase?
That occurred recently after the trial.
And the defendant took the stand where in that process?
My recollection is he would have been the, I'm sorry, I can't remember.
Well, were there days that transpired between his testimony and the doctor's testimony?
No, I believe this occurred the same day.
The same day. So one is left then to infer either that the lawyers did not talk to the doctor before they put him on the stand, or that they did and at least had the opportunity to know of his testimony before they put the defendant on the stand.
Well, I think it was, yes, that's a very legitimate conclusion. What I think is this: they put together a very well-prepared life history mitigation theory, and they put it on the stand. Part of that included calling the defendant. When you call a criminal defendant to the stand, he comes with a lot of baggage. That's not what the defense attorneys call it. They can prepare him until the cows come home, and there's no telling what he's going to say if he gets out there. That's beyond their control. Everybody, all of you are veteran judges. You have seen this happen before. You cannot control what a person's going to say. Probably beyond doubt a person in this particular defendant's position, who knows what he wants to say. He got out there and he said this. That's just a risk you have to take. You know, if you determine to put him on and you choose the unsworn statement format, you cannot control that format. You cannot ask questions. He is up there and he speaks. It's almost chain of
comments. Okay. You do that and he speaks as he did here. Let's say it's a surprise. You didn't know he was going to make the claims that it was accidental. And you do know your doc has a confession to the contrary. Is it ineffective assistance of counsel then to put the doc up after the surprise from the defendant?
Absolutely not, Judge, because who are we kidding here? The jury already knows he did it. He's not fooling you anymore. He may be trying to salve his conscience by saying that. But the fact is, counsel's got a choice to make. Here we've got a good, well-prepared life history, mitigation theory. We're going to put it on. This defendant, what if they even do it in advance? He's going to say that. He still is going to get up there and say that. It's not going to impact on anything. Their choice to make a balance test. Is it better to forego the life history defense? Let him get up there and say something that the jury has already found beyond reasonable doubt is not true? Or should we go ahead with our life history defense? Let him say that for what it's worth and go ahead. That's a tactical decision that they get to make. And that's what they did. I mean, if you're on the jury, are you going to be shocked if the defendant gets up and says that? No, you realize they're going to claim their innocence that they're in. But they have already found him guilty. So the fact that the doctor comes up and says the same thing is not being quoted with him. It's not catching him by surprise. It doesn't cause him to look at the defense attorneys and say, my God.
as a juror, though, you're going to be presumably more willing to at least think about the possibility of giving life instead of death if the defendant, if you already arrived at that conclusion and the defendant knows that he's admitted to the doc the same thing if he took the stand and said, it was a terribly dumb thing that I did, and I don't know what I was thinking. I've got a religious sense, and on and on and on. And instead of getting up and trying to hand off a direct fabrication, knowing as he should have that the next witness in the box or a succeeding witness is going to contradict the story in spades.
I think if you step back and look at this in the context of all capital cases, this court has reviewed how many, there's been a large number where alternative theories of mitigation have been presented. In almost every case where a defendant has tried to present a residual doubt of defense, his attorneys have also gone ahead and presented some type of life history mitigation justification. About the alternative nature, apparently, of what's being presented, that really is not inconsistent, and it's really not uncommon. It's happened in almost all the cases that you reviewed where residual doubt is based. Residual doubt seldom is presented by itself. It's almost always accompanied by some type of mitigation. And when you get right down to it, that's really what occurred here. You know, the attorneys have a witness, they have a lot of good things to say, you can bolster their defense. And you also get something balanced. They had to make a decision. You know, what's better in the law, if they balance the beneficial effect versus the prejudicial effect, they determine who's better to go ahead and do this. Court has no questions.
Thank you, Mr. Breyer. Ms. Agar, you've saved a little over 9 minutes of your time.
About how mitigation will be presented. this is a very typical and maybe better than some mitigation presentation, in that there was an expert, there was three family members, if I'm right. So even in 3 days, they seem to rally the troops in a fashion that is consistent with other non-deficient presentations. It seems to me, given that, that your focus must be the fact that the defendant himself is not properly prepared by counsel to give his statement in a fashion that would conform to the eventuality of Schiaffone, you know, telling the jury, no, he told me that he contradicted Schiaffone. Isn't that the biggest problem?
No, I think the problem is that it's not the number of mitigation witnesses that you present that is the mitigating circumstance. If the testimony is not properly prepared, if there's no reason, theory of mitigation, you can call 20 witnesses and make no impact at all on the jury. And in fact, the defense in this case would have been much better off if they'd called fewer witnesses, particularly one fewer, not put Dr. Schiaffone on the witness.
Or is that the only thing I'm trying to get you to say about what the defendant said? Isn't that where you really have a problem, that Dr. Schiaffone having contradicted a statement given by the defendant?
Sure, if you're going to take this, what the prosecutor indicated, the typical mitigation approach, which as far as I can tell, has almost a zero effectiveness. But if that's the only approach you have, and you decide that's the only approach you have, and you're going to take it, then surely, yes, you have to coordinate the testimony of your witnesses so that everybody is on the same page with that approach. And clearly that wasn't done here.
Although,
if you have to use Dr. Schiaffone, then you have to explain to the defendant, you made these statements to Dr. Schiaffone, you have to confront him with him and tell him that the jury is going to hear about it. He has to know that before he makes his unsworn statement.
And perhaps he didn't take advice from counsel. I mean, this is a very tough area, isn't it? Because they don't know if counsel may have told the defendant, well, take this tack.
There is that possibility, but it doesn't seem likely since counsel had already requested a residual doubt instruction. It's clear that was part of the mitigation strategy, was the residual doubt question in terms of whether the killing was premeditated and intent to silence the witness, or whether it wasn't spur of the moment accident or not the thing. So no, it doesn't seem likely that given that.
What's the effect on the jury issue? Because that's all that we can really consider here in mitigation. I mean, your client is only prejudiced in the mitigation phase if the jury doesn't feel that the death penalty is not warranted.
Well, I think you could interview 100 trial attorneys and ask them what the most devastating thing that happened in front of the jury is, and that 99 of them will probably say having the client caught in a bald-faced lie in front of the jury. And that's what happened here. The impact is absolutely devastating.
And yet they know he was didn't they know in the defense was it was accidental? Didn't they already determine he was lying? The defense was opposite to the findings.
Well, that's where the entire question of residual doubt comes in. And this court and a number of other courts have determined that the defendant is entitled to present residual doubt as a mitigating factor. And that's why we're talking about mitigation here, not about the elevation of the trial. The jury did find beyond a reasonable doubt that this was killing of the witness. However, the defendant is still entitled to that last legally residual doubt the jury might have about his state of mind at the time of his killing took place. Dr. Schiaffone's testimony wiped out that last legally residual doubt.
Thank you, Ms. Agar. The case is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion.